I'm going to start the stopwatch.
Or perhaps it was the echo.
I'm stopping it again. I've started it.
The CMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, Sony ATV, ATP, YouTube and Kanye West. Welcome to the CMU podcast. The week in music and the business of music, and I still haven't thought of a good strap line for this podcast.
I think that's quite apparent.
I'm Andy Bolt, editor of CMU. My guest this week is Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. And Chris, you're privileged to be the last guest on this podcast for a month.
Yes, on the current series of the CMU
is that what
podcast.
We're calling it?
We're calling them series.
Right.
Yes.
What series are we on now?
Two.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because we took a break over Christmas, as you'll remember. So
right.
That was the end of Series 1 and the start of Series 2.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came back last July. When we came back last summer,
yeah,
after the prolonged break, that was a reboot.
Right.
Okay, so we're not counting
it was
any,
grittier.
We're not counting any series that went before, because this is a new version of CMU Podcast. So this is the end of Series 2. We are going away for a whole month. Partly because we have a very busy month, not least because The Great Escape is incoming. I spoke about The Great Escape. Actually, that wasn't last week's podcast, was it? Or was it?
I think you've spoken about The Great Escape on every podcast for the last 6 months.
Ever. So The Great Escape is happening. Well, as we record this, we are exactly 4 weeks away from The Great Escape. And that all kicks off on the 19th of May. And CMU, we present our CMU Insights at The Great Escape Conference on the Thursday and the Friday. Two rooms, 2 days, lots of things. Yeah, my slogan for that's as good as your slogan for the podcast. I'll work on that. So that's happening on the Thursday and the Friday. And then the Saturday, day three of The Great Escape, we have CMU DIY at The Great Escape. So that's all of our stuff for new artists and future industry talent. So in total, 3 days of talks and discussions and presentations and interviews presented by us as part of The Great Escape, alongside all of the other madness. Madness aren't playing. But there will be lots of madness across Brighton over the 3 days as the big new music festival of the UK takes place. But that's not the only thing happening over this little month where the podcast is going away. What else is happening?
We're going to go to Canada.
We're going to Canada.
We're going on holiday together.
we are. So we're going to Canadian Music Week, which is the first week in May, happening across Toronto. And on the Friday of the proceedings, the 6th of May, we are presenting CMU Insights at Canadian Music Week.
Yeah, it's not actually a holiday.
So 3 hours, we'll be looking at the UK music market, we'll be looking at some interesting digital developments, and then we've got 4 great British independent music companies represented talking about the indie sector. So that's CMU Insights at Canadian Music Week. So if you're in Toronto and you're at CMW...
And why wouldn't you be?
Why, I don't know why you wouldn't be. Then make sure you check us out on the Friday afternoon. We'll be around there for the whole of the event though, won't we?
Yeah.
And I'm also doing some panels on the Saturday. We're doing a Dissecting Digital Dollar panel on the Saturday as well. So we'll be around at Canadian Music Week for most of the festivities. In addition to that, if you're going to Music Connected, which is the Association of Independent Music's digital conference, which is taking place next week, I'm doing a Digital Dollar How Digital Licensing Works session that you have to book in advance for. So book in advance. And that's happening next week. And then tomorrow/today... So tomorrow as we record this.
Friday.
I'm up in Edinburgh for Wide Days. It's CMU Insights at Wide Days, which is also about digital licensing. And we'll be talking to some people about how you get your content into streaming services. If you're a little artist, I meant to say a little label then. A new artist, self-releasing artist, or a little label. Not if you're just a small artist. Although what we're going to say applies to small artists if you are a little artist. We'll also be talking about playlisting, and we will update everybody on the Music Managers Forum's Dissecting the Digital Dollar project, from which the report I'll be talking about came, because we're currently in phase 2 of that project, and Fiona from the MMF will be updating us on how that is going. So what's that? Wide Days, Music Connected, Canadian Music Week, The Great Escape. This is why we're taking a month off the podcast. We've got a very busy few weeks of CMU Insights goodness occurring in various cities around mainly the United Kingdom, but also the world.
Yes, we're global.
We are.
We're a global business.
So, CMUinsights.com is where you should go for information on all of that. And while you're there, why not book into one of our seminars or masterclasses that are happening in June and July?
Well, that is not one of the things I listed to plug, so look at you.
I'm going beyond the plug quota at the start of this podcast.
No more plugs.
So this is the last podcast for 4 weeks, but we will be back in the last Friday of May. Is that what we're
26th,
looking at?
26th, so I think it is. That will be... Oh, no, actually, maybe that's the day we record it. 27th.
It will be
one
the...
of those days.
The Chris
should
Cook
have just stuck with the last week.
Birthday edition, of course.
What?
Because my birthday is a couple of days
after.
You
famously
that.
Don't celebrate your birthday.
I same famously don't
so,
celebrate
so
my birthday.
So don't send in cakes.
But you are welcome to send
no,
in
wait,
cakes.
No, wait, do send in cakes.
And we will just pretend that they're for something. They'll be the return of the podcast cake rather than the Chris's birthday cake.
Okay, so make sure you ice that onto the top of the cake.
We will return, and we've also hopefully got an actual guest for one of our podcasts, probably in early June, which will be a very interesting conversation. Probably a guest who might disagree with us on quite a few things. So look out for news on that. Hopefully we'll get all of that organised while we're away. And, I don't know, the second or the third podcast back, we'll have a guest participating in the debate here on the podcast. And then your guest pun won't work again because we'll have genuine guests, which does occasionally happen. For this final podcast of this series, this second series of the CMU podcast,
yeah,
we've moved into the mini studio, the little tiny room.
Yeah.
And so if you hear a thumping, I gesticulate quite a lot when I start talking. When I get animated, when I start talking about copyright, are we talking about copyright today? Actually, I don't think we are, so it probably won't happen. I tend to gesticulate quite a lot, but I'm sitting very close to a wall today. And although it's padded, because it's a studio, I think you might be able to hear me thumping the wall. So if there's any noises that you're not used to, or echoes or anything, it's because we're in the
mini
studio.
Remain calm. It's
so,
all fine.
It'll all be good. Everything will go as normal. It's more of an intimate. It's like what you say when you're playing a smaller venue than you'd really like to. It's an intimate edition of the CMU podcast to wrap up this second series.
Yes. Well, let's get on to the first story of this week, which is a good one. Warner v. Sony. Who doesn't like a good major label battle? In fact, it's more than that. It's a major and indie label battle against a major. It's complicated. What's going on?
It's complicated by the way you just described it.
It's not actually that complicated.
So this is Sony ATV. Sony Corp, as we know, is buying out the Michael Jackson estate from its music publishing joint venture, Sony ATV. We talked about that a few weeks ago, I'm sure.
I'm sure we did, yes.
Because they announced that this was happening last month in March. So the Sony Entertainment business that's based in Japan actually owns three different music companies in total. So first of all, there's Sony Music Japan, which is totally separate. Then there's the Sony Music Record Company, which is the global record company everywhere except Japan,
yep,
run out of the US. And then there is Sony ATV, which is the music publishing company. So the Sony company that controls and exploits song copyrights as opposed to recording copyrights.
But it doesn't outright own Sony ATV.
As it currently stands, it does not. So Sony ATV came about when two companies merged, Sony and ATV,
yeah,
back in the 90s.
They didn't put a lot of thought into the name.
So the Sony Music Publishing Company and the ATV Music Publishing Company merged in the 90s. The ATV Publishing Company comes from way back in the day and began as the music publishing spin-off of ATV, which was one of the original ITV companies. So the TV bit of ATV refers to the fact that ATV used to be, I think it was the ITV company in East Anglia. Do you remember when the ITV companies all had different names depending on where you lived?
Yeah.
So I come
the
from...
The Anglia, I think the East Anglia one at that time would have probably had its rotating silver horse knight statue thing.
Possibly. Who knows? So that's where ATV comes from. They moved into music publishing. They did a very clever deal where they bought Northern Songs, which obviously owns most of the Lennon-McCartney Beatle repertoire. And then the ATV publishing company came up for sale in the mid-80s. Michael Jackson bid for it, won it, bought it, had it, and then subsequently merged it with Sony, Sony being his long-term record company as well. So that's where his business relationship with Sony came. And so Sony ATV, although Sony owned 50% of it, unlike the Sony record company and the music company in Japan, is not a wholly owned business. And even after Michael Jackson died, then that continued. And so Sony went from having Jackson himself as a business partner in the music publishing business to having the Michael Jackson estate as a business partner, who I suspect was probably an easier business partner to work with. Nevertheless, last year it was revealed that the joint venture contract between the Sony business and the Michael Jackson estate that covered Sony ATV had a clause in it where every so often each side had the option to buy the other side out. And then we found out last month that Sony had done a deal and that they were going to buy the Michael Jackson estate out. And earlier this week, that deal was actually properly finalised. So we were told it was going to happen about a month ago. But the deal was properly finalised this week. However, although the deal has now in theory been done, because Sony is such a big player in the music rights industry as the second biggest major record company, Sony ATV is the biggest music publisher. Because of all of that, this deal needs competition regulator approval, because basically it is Sony Core at the top increasing its interest in the music rights business. So it will need to go before the competition regulators in the key countries where it operates. The US competition regulator, whenever music companies merge, always says, yeah, whatever. So that won't be a problem. It is always the European Commission, the European Union, where big mergers in the music industry get some really big scrutiny. I mean, the outcome of that scrutiny usually is, yeah, merge. But there is much more scrutiny within the European Union about these deals. And that's the news this week that, according to Bloomberg, lawyers representing Warner Music have already had a meeting with the European Commission to discuss this transaction. Impala, which is the trade group that represents the indie labels in Europe, which is always very vocal when the big music companies try to consolidate and increase their interests, has already gone public on saying that they will oppose this in Europe. There are rumours that BMG, another big music rights company, particularly in the publishing space, may also object. So the question is, as the competition regulators in Europe investigate this transaction, they could do it within a month and just say, yeah, go ahead, whatever. But if there's enough opposition, they might open up a full 4-month investigation that would scrutinise the transaction in much more detail and decide whether or not it is something where the competition regulator should intervene.
Yeah, and that's something we've already seen happen in recent memory, because when EMI was split up and sold, Sony ATV bought the publishing side of EMI, and although there was more scrutiny of Universal buying its record labels, there was scrutiny of Sony ATV buying EMI publishing, and it did go to a full investigation, and ultimately it was decided that indeed just outright merging the two would make that company too big. So making Sony ATV a wholly owned division of Sony would presumably trigger the same concerns.
Certainly, that's what Impala reckons. So they are saying when EMI was split up, as you said, and sold off, and the record company went to Universal, and the publisher went to Sony ATV, the comments that were made about the Sony ATV transaction at the time by the European Commission and the competition regulators there, in Impala's interpretation of what they said, would suggest that Sony taking complete ownership of the Sony ATV business should be a concern. Now, it's worth mentioning that when Sony ATV bought the EMI music publishing business, which is what made Sony ATV by far the big major player in music publishing, however, it doesn't actually own the EMI bit outright. Yeah. There were other bidders involved. So as well as Sony and the Michael Jackson estate, there were two or three other players who bought the EMI music publishing business, and they still own that. And this transaction won't change that. So the EMI music publishing bit is still controlled by more than one party. Sony Core will not control that outright. However, day to day, EMI Music Publishing operates as if it was a subsidiary of Sony ATV. So basically, Sony ATV does all of the administration and management of the songs and the rights, which are technically owned by the joint venture that bought EMI Music Publishing. So Sony ATV is an incredible, powerful beast, and it will be interesting to see whether or not the regulators listen. I mean, it was interesting back in 2012 when the EMI transaction was going through, although, as you say, both of the transactions got quite a bit of scrutiny, you felt that the regulators went much more full on in investigating and then making demands of Universal on the record company side than they did on the Sony ATV side. And it was always interesting at the time, well, why is that? Because the Sony ATV transaction was as big as Universal acquiring the EMI record companies. I think it was partly because the Sony ATV deal was more complicated, because there were other shareholders, other investors involved. So I think that complicated things that made it perhaps seem less of an issue to the regulator than it otherwise would have done. There is also the issue that on the publishing side, because the argument that will be given by a Warner or a BMG, certainly the indies, is that as Sony takes complete control of ever increasing amounts of music rights, whether that's recordings or songs, it then becomes too dominant in the market, and that means it can make unfair or unreasonable or excessive demands of potential licensees, particularly in the digital space where you've got services who need to access pretty much the entire repertoire. And Sony, with Sony ATV over here and Sony Music over here, collectively become so powerful that they have an unfair advantage in those negotiations, and that, the argument goes, potentially contravenes competition law. Although it's always worth remembering, on the publishing side, when it comes to song copyrights, in continental Europe, actually, generally, it's the collecting societies that negotiate those digital deals. When it comes to Anglo-American repertoire, so that would include the UK and the songs which are usually represented by PRS, actually, Sony ATV has taken the negotiating element of the digital deals in-house. So if you're starting up a Spotify-type service to access Anglo-American repertoire, you actually do a deal with Sony ATV, even though, in a complicated fashion, you're also accessing performing rights that are controlled by PRS. Whereas in mainland Europe, that does not happen. So SACEM in France does the big deals, GAMO in Germany occasionally does deals. And so one of the arguments Sony ATV might use is, OK, we control a big chunk of repertoire, and by taking complete ownership of Sony ATV, we, Sony, have more control over that than we previously did. However, when it comes to the big song copyright deals in the digital space, ultimately, it's SACEM, it's GAMO, it's the other collecting societies who hold the power, the control, and do the deal, and therefore don't worry about it.
That said, Sony ATV has this week done a direct deal with SoundCloud for its premium streaming service.
Although, again, that will be Anglo-American repertoire. But you're right, when it comes to Anglo-American repertoire, which arguably, well, this is us coming from a UK perspective, it's an arrogant thing to say, but you know, for a lot of streaming services, Anglo-American repertoire is the most important bit for a service starting, like SoundCloud with its premium service. So yes, Sony ATV is doing those direct deals of Anglo-American repertoire, and is making quite a big deal about the fact that it's getting better terms for its songwriters and its competitors, because we're Sony ATV and we can make those demands. So yeah, it is over here stomping around saying we're big, we're important, we should get better deals. But over here in Europe, it will probably be saying, well, we don't do that much stomping. It's interesting, although not surprising, Bloomberg sources, who I say that Warner has already had conversations with Europe. BMG, it seems to be, are thinking about it, say those mysterious anonymous sources. Universal are not going to object, but I should think so too, yeah. Because it has the biggest of the record companies and is also a sizable player.
People looking at Universal.
Well, exactly. There's an element of throwing stones in glass houses or whatever the expression is. So yes, Universal would rather the European Commission not have overpowerful, over-consuming music rights companies in their minds any more than is absolutely necessary. So Universal is unlikely to oppose here. So these are all currently rumours. It will be interesting to see whether or not actually this all speeds through the European Commission really quickly and isn't controversial, or if they do instigate that big investigation, whether or not a simple change of ownership is sufficient. We will see. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine that the European Commission would stop this transaction, would stop this sale. However, what they do sometimes do, when they feel that one company is becoming too powerful in the music rights space, is they will force catalogue sales.
Yeah.
Which is what we saw happen when EMI
get rid
was
of
sold.
The Beatles. Don't
yeah,
need that.
Yeah. If there's one thing Sony ATV are not going to give up, it's their rights to the Beatles catalogue, even if, as I think we discussed recently on the podcast, they're potentially going to lose Paul McCartney's share in the US anyway because of American copyright law and the reversion rights. But as with Universal, when Universal gave up the entirety of Parlophone, I mean, they didn't give it up for free, they sold it to Warner, but when Universal, in order to get the approval of their EMI deal in Europe, said, all right then, we'll sell Parlophone, which is one of the jewels in the EMI crown, we'll give that up in order to get the rubber stamp, oh, but minus the Beatles.
Yeah.
So if there's one thing Sony ATV won't be giving up, it'll be the Beatles catalogue. But that could be the outcome, that they may say to Sony, all right then, you can take complete control of this, even though that increases your power as Sony Corp within the music rights industry, providing you give up some of the, you know, decent, valuable catalogues within your repertoire, which will then go on the market and be sold. And I suppose companies like BMG, who have grown rapidly in the recent years through catalogue acquisition, by mopping up these catalogues when they go up on sale, for a company like BMG, that would actually be of interest. I'm sure they would be in there seeing if they could negotiate a deal. So that could be the outcome of this, or it could be that these rumours sort of come to nothing. European regulators just rubber stamp this deal and it will turn out that this entire section of our podcast was redundant. But it was nice to talk about.
Well, we'll see either way in a month's time.
Indeed, we'll find out when we return. Either Sony ATV will be a wholly owned subsidiary of the wider Sony Entertainment business, or it will all still be to play for in Brussels. We'll see.
Now, contrary to what the rumour mill would have had you believe in the run-up to it, last weekend, the Stuart Lee-curated ATP Festival did go ahead as planned, where it was planned. But this weekend coming, the Drive Like Jehu-curated ATP Festival is not going ahead where it was planned in either location
Where it was planned or where it wasn't planned.
Basically, what I'm saying is it's been cancelled.
Yes, so the second of the ATP festivals isn't happening, which I think comes as a surprise to no one.
No, at all, yeah.
So I suppose let's quickly recap. This is the sort of the conclusion, the finale of a quite long-running story. Well, let's just talk about this chapter. Let's not go all the way back to the very start of the ATP cancellations.
No, well, this one. So there were rumours in March, I think, that both these festivals were not going ahead, mainly because Pontins, where they were supposed to be happening, started selling chalets to the general public, which is not a good sign.
For the weekend when the
event the weekend when place. They were supposed to be taking place, or for the weekends, rather. And then ATP came out and went, no, it's fine, it's just a misunderstanding. The misunderstanding turned out to be that ATP had not paid Pontins, so Pontins had put the chalets on sale, which is presumably just standard procedure. But then it was all sorted out for one of the events, so the Stuart Lee one, that was all sorted, all fine.
Yeah, because when that was happening, and obviously without wishing to backtrack all the way this back to, I'm pretty sure it was the first All Tomorrow's Parties. So the first event of this format run by the guys who run ATP was called the Bowley Weekender, and that was a big success. And then the second one, which was the first one, called All Tomorrow's Parties, I'm pretty sure that was also cancelled, because around about then, we're talking about 1999. I remember this because we did this was when CMU was a print magazine, and we did a special edition all about the ATP event that then didn't happen. So we had to pulp an issue of the magazine. So that's why that sort of sticks in my mind.
Sort of memorable.
Then you had a number of years of the ATP festivals all being very popular and very successful, and then they sort of became less popular and less successful. I think partly because the novelty of going to a holiday camp and watching a load of interestingly curated and alternative, but some big name alternative acts sort of started to wane. Some other people tried the format as well. So you had a number of ATP events that didn't go ahead. And not just the ATP branded events. The ATP, the company, also had some other festivals in London that then got cancelled.
Or downsized.
Or significantly downsized at the last minute. So basically, ATP is a brand and a company that has got itself a bit of a reputation, certainly in recent years, or if you want to, trace it all the way back to the 90s, of cancelling events quite last minute. So I suppose that is why, when these rumours started spreading, that, oh, hang on a second, Pontins in Prestatyn seem to think that these festivals have been cancelled, and then ATP quickly got onto Facebook and said, oh, no, it's a misunderstanding. We were like, is it really?
Yeah.
And then there was about a few days where the official line from ATP was, oh, we're sorting this, it's all going to be fine. Pontins will be confirming from their end that these events are definitely going ahead very shortly. And then they did confirm that the Stuart Lee event was going ahead, but suspiciously, only the Stuart Lee event was going ahead. And so that was like, well, that's a bit suspicious. And then, of course, the announcement that followed at that point was, oh, the second event is going ahead, but not at Pontins in Prestatyn.
No, in Manchester, which in a warehouse with no accommodation, which is quite a significantly different event.
It is.
And they did, but ATP said, don't worry, it's all fine. Your tickets are all still valid. You can now buy day tickets as well. So anyone in Manchester can come and fill the gaps. And anyone who bought tickets for the original festival, we'll put you up in a hotel. Don't worry about it. Your accommodation is still set. All fine, nothing to worry about.
And if you've seen the photos of the chalets at Pontins in Prestatyn on the internet, you'll probably like the little travel lodge we're going to put you in instead of the slightly windswept holiday camp in North Wales. And that was the deal. And then the guy who owns the warehouse space where all of this was going to happen put out a statement saying, really excited about this. This is the start of a great partnership. We and ATP.
Did seem a little bit over-optimistic.
taking the sort of the curation and style of ATP events and doing them in central Manchester, where this is going to be the start of something magnificent. But it wasn't to be.
No, so during the Stuart Lee event, rumours started spreading that Drive Like Jehu's event the next weekend was not going to be going ahead at all. There were kind of, well, there were cancellations at the Stuart Lee event. There were apparently like artists wandering around being annoyed. There were problems with chalets. But for the most part, it seemed to have gone okay.
Yeah, if you looked at the social networks, there were a few people bickering about a few points. But a quick scan of sort of the relevant hashtags on Twitter and Facebook, there were certainly more people having a good time than a bad time, as far as I can see. And Stuart Lee made the whole debacle the subject of his entire stand-up set, as far as I can see. And so it's sort of, I don't know, I sense I didn't go. I actually do know a couple of people who did go, but I've been really bad in terms of researching for this podcast. I've actually managed to speak to them since they went. You sort of sensed that there was a sort of camaraderie amongst most of the people there in a, we're going to have a great time with some great bands as this brand literally falls apart around us. And sure enough, as the weekend progressed, although the feedback of the actual event seemed to be quite good, the rumours about the Manchester gig started to spread. Oh, the word on the grapevine here is it ain't happening.
Yeah, and now if you do any sort of, I don't know if you can do courses in this, but if you look at any research and training on how to manage a crisis at a festival, top of the list is you need to own the story as quickly as possible. So you need to be putting out statements on social media. You need to make sure you are controlling the information. What you don't want is for the artist you're working with on the creation to start issuing angry statements, which is exactly, it's not the first time it's happened to ATP, but this is exactly what happened on this occasion.
I mean,
the statement came from Drive Like Jehu, and it was not happy because this event that was less than a week away now had suddenly fallen apart, and they felt they weren't receiving proper communications about it.
No, I suppose like Stuart Lee, I mean, when the original confusion about whether or not any of the events were going ahead were happening, people reached out to Stuart Lee as the curator, because of course the whole point about Ultimo's parties is every edition has a celebrity curator, sometimes an artist, actually usually an artist, but sometimes not. And so Stuart Lee was an example of that. And the curators, in theory, are choosing the bands and putting it together. And they certainly have some input on what bands play. But what it means is when these events start to untangle and ATP's PR often doesn't seem to have any more information than the rest of us, people then reach out to the curators. And Stuart Lee had said, and then Drive Like Jehu said in their statement, we only know what you know. We're getting updates through the same Twitter and Facebook feeds.
Yeah, and actually what they said was kind of over the weekend they'd heard from bands who they'd obviously kind of asked to come and play, who were saying, well, we've not had our guarantee, so we can't afford to travel to the event. So we can't, you know, we're not cancelling because we don't want to play it. We're cancelling because we can't. We don't have the money to do it.
And a lot of the bands that they book aren't superstar artists who can dip into their own cash flow. They are bands which, if we don't have our expenses covered and a bit of guarantee before we leave for Manchester, we literally can't afford to get there.
And then it emerged that the people who were supposed to have had new accommodation sorted out in Manchester had not had any sort of accommodation confirmed.
And I noticed some Facebook conversation of that on the ATP Facebook profile, where some of the ticket buyers were saying, it's a week away now and we still haven't heard which hotels we're staying at, and we've just done a quick Google search of all the hotels within walking distance of the venue and they're all fully booked. And then someone else was saying, oh, they'll be fully booked because ATP have booked them for you. That's why they'll be fully booked. And then someone else was going, well, why haven't they told
us? That's splitting a lot of trust in ATP.
So as you say, the rumours were spinning all over the weekend and then first thing Monday morning. And I suppose, to be fair, once Team ATP were on site in Prestatyn, they were busy running a festival. Really, they should have made this call and made this announcement before that event began, because the confirmation, as you say, came from the Drive Like Jehu Facebook profile in a statement that wasn't especially complimentary about the organisers of the event and was basically saying, we should have known, but we really wanted this event to happen. And so we trusted the organisers when they kept telling us the different plans that they had. And we even looked, this is the band speaking, we even looked into whether or not we could do a free gig on our own, so our fans, if they happen to be in Manchester, could come and see it. But there aren't any venues available. It ain't happening. And then, wasn't it, the final proposal from ATP HQ was, oh, we'll push it back to the autumn. Let's do it in the autumn.
Do it in November.
That's when one of these events should happen. And that was the point at which seemingly the band whose name and brand was associated with this crumbling event said, no, that's it. Let's draw a line. We're just not going to do it. And then a few hours later, an official announcement went up on ATP's Facebook profile.
Yeah, where they said, well, you know, these things happen, but you'll all get your money back. And also, not only, you know, ticket buyers, you'll all get your money back, but if you have got any non-refundable costs like train tickets, hotels, whatever, we'll also cover those costs. That's all fine. I also know from speaking to people about this, there's people who are still waiting for money from the Jabberwocky Festival. So
yes, which is one of the London events that ATP tried to put on and again got cancelled very much at the last minute. So yeah, quite bold commitments being made by Team ATP. I imagine if you'd bought day tickets, which only recently went on sale, because of course it was only when they shifted to Manchester, day tickets became an option. I suspect that that money hasn't even left the ticketing provider, so the ticketing companies will be able to refund that money quite easily. If you've bought the free day tickets, well, in the main, people were buying them directly off ATP rather than through a ticketing company. And the advantage of a Ticketmaster, as much as everyone loves to hate Ticketmaster, the advantage of buying tickets through a big ticketing company is you know that if the event doesn't go ahead and the law says you're due a refund, well, Ticketmaster ain't going to go out of business. So there'll always be somebody for you or for your bank or your credit card company to go and get the money off. Whereas if you're buying them directly off a promoter, if the promoter then has to declare themselves bankrupt, which it has happened before when ATP events have collapsed, well, there ain't no money available. Now, if you've bought on a credit card, usually under European law, you'll get your money back anyway for your credit card company. But as for refunds for accommodation or travel costs that you can't get refunded from either the hotel or the train company or whatever, well, you don't really have any protection on there. So you are just taking the goodwill that ATP have said in their statement that they're willing to offer, but certainly the Drive Like Yahoo statement was very adamant that ATP ain't got no money. There might be some profits from Stuart Lee event, I suppose, which could be used to satisfy those commitments. Who knows?
There's also the ATP Iceland Festival that's coming up.
Yeah, there is.
Maybe there'll be some money from that.
Maybe there will. That's a separate company. They're always very keen to stress that. So whatever happens to ATP events in the UK, it shouldn't affect the event in Iceland. But as we say, this has now happened so many times with ATP organised events. And ATP, which is run by a guy called Barry Hogan, who's a really nice guy, and he's done lots of really interesting things as a promoter over the years. Although you do sort of sense, well, I mean, we probably would have said this 2 or 3 years ago. You do sort of sense that he has used up every little bit of goodwill, because a lot of artists and a lot of fans and people in the industry like the idea of ATP. And when it's worked, it's really worked. And so people like it. But I think there's only so many times an event can collapse. There's only so many times other people can lose money before eventually. I mean, most agents already, certainly in the last couple of years, will say to artists who want to play an ATP event, well, you do so at your risk. Me, as your booking agent, I'm telling you, don't do this gig. But if you really want to do it, then do it. But you have to think that the goodwill amongst artists and all the other people that help events like this happen, there can't be any of that left. Surely not in the UK. Certainly under the ATP name.
Yeah. No, it's... well, like you say, you would have thought that goodwill would have run out already.
Although
I think actually having Stuart Lee as a curator was quite a clever booking. I think that, I mean, Stuart Lee gave that interview to The Quietest where he was saying, this is, you know, I wouldn't normally do an event like this, but I've enjoyed ATPs in the past, so I wanted to do it. But now it's stressful because it's my name attached to this. They're using my reputation.
Because ATP themselves, a few years ago, said the Holiday Park events have run the course, we can't make them work anymore. And they officially parked the Holiday Camp Festival format, only to bring it back.
Yes, not that long afterwards.
So I think you're right. With the Stuart Lee event in particular, they were trading on the back of a probably more established curator than they've had in the past. Also opens the whole thing up perhaps to a slightly different audience than usually. So that was an interesting booking. Perhaps that bought them that extra bit of goodwill. And the event did happen. And most people seem to have enjoyed themselves. But you have to think that it's going to be really hard for the ATP team under that name, through that business, to persuade enough artists and other people who are involved in organising these events, venues for starters, and ticket buyers to sort of buy into these events again. Although I did see a few people on social networks saying, that's it, never going to another ATP organised event. Oh, unless they persuade X to be the curator. And there were always certain artists. It's like, oh, if they could get that band back together to curate an ATP, well, perhaps I'd take the risk. But then I suppose there's an element of, as a punter, you're taking a risk for £200 or £300. And generally speaking, if you buy it through Visa, probably you'll get your money back. It's more on the industry side. It's artists and suppliers to the events, PR companies, ticketing companies, who actually take quite sizable risks, which if the company goes under, usually they don't really see any money back at all. So even if you could persuade ticket buyers to come, can you persuade enough of the other people involved to make it happen? And as you say, the final quote, I mean, ATP over the years have generally been very apologetic when the events go wrong. Although the most recent one, much more, was sort of, I don't know, well, I was inferring it, whether or not they were implying it, along the lines of, well, we try and do these edgy events. No one else does these edgy events. And sometimes edgy events go horribly wrong. But if you want edgy events, then you just got to take the risk with us. Seems to be almost what they were implying. And on one level, yeah, it is hard to put on edgy alternative music events.
That is why they've managed to kind of carry on going.
But on another level, almost as the promoter, it's sort of your job to make it happen and not to have it collapse 7 days before the event is due to happen on the grapevine with the artists having to put out
the short notice as much as anything, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's not about, like, Jabberwocky was 3 days, wasn't it, which was a lot worse. But still, you know, less than a week is... You need to be cancelling a lot further before that. I presume we knew that they knew there were problems. Probably would have been better at the point the Stuart Lee event was confirmed at that point, just go, look, we can do this one, but two is too much, rather than going like, oh, we'll just move it to Manchester and that'll definitely be fine.
And you assume the only reason for doing two events so close together, which is quite ambitious, bearing in mind ATP is a small little company and they've tried working with bigger companies in the past. There was a very short-lived deal with the Mama company.
Very short-lived.
Very short-lived. That didn't actually result in any events. But they are a small company. So to do two events quite so close together, but I assume one of the reasons for doing that is if it's at the same site, then there are economies of scale because you put all the setup for the site, so you might as well use it 2 weeks because it won't be double the rental cost and so on and so forth. But the minute you shift the second event to a totally different location and a totally different operation, then those economies of scale remove and now you're stuck with two ambitious events right next to each other. So that possibly wasn't a wise decision. Anyway, will ATP return or not? And really, it would be great if Barry and the rest of the ATP team could find a business partner, so you could have a business partner with a bit more money and perhaps a little bit more business savvy, but who would welcome the sort of the curation and artistic skills of the ATP team. It's whether or not that commercial creative alliance could ever exist without going horribly wrong quite quickly. But as it currently stands, all tomorrow's parties are cancelled except ATP Iceland. So if you're Icelandic, enjoy your ATP when it comes along. Perhaps make the most of it, because who knows, perhaps that could be the last ever one. CMU approves time, the final verbal approved for a few weeks, so you'll have to go back to reading the CMU approved until the end of May. But if you didn't read any of this week's CMU approved, do not worry, because Andy Moles is going to talk you through them and tell you why you should be checking out these artists and these tracks now.
William Tyler.
Yeah.
William Tyler is a, what would you say?
I don't know.
He's like an instrumental 12-string guitarist guy. He's been around for a few years. He's very good. He regularly manages to draw a lot more out of a 12-string guitar instrumental than you would think is really feasible in this day and age. But he finds new things to do with the instrument over and over again. He's got a new album called Modern Country coming out in June, and he's just released the first single from it called Gone Clear, which is a really, like, it's really, really good.
And that's what you're approving.
So
So next... How do you even say SH question mark M?
Shem.
Of course.
Shem is a grime producer based in London. He's released a track called Mob Boss, which is the title track of his new EP. Eagle-eared folks might know the track from the beat that appeared under a freestyle on SBTV last year with Stormzy, Aaron Unknown, DEE, and Lady Leisure.
All freestyling over it.
Apparently you're supposed to pronounce it. I've been getting it wrong all these years. Anyway, it's the title track of this EP. It's really...
And so this is just the instrumental.
It's just the instrumental.
No freestyling on top.
Really, whereas, you know, some like grime and hip-hop instrumentals don't really stand up on their own. His tracks really do. This is his second EP. He's apparently got more stuff coming out later this year. He's really good. He's becoming more in demand, so I think he's someone you're going to be hearing a lot of.
So go check that out and enjoy it for what it is, or have a little freestyle yourself.
Yeah, why not?
Use it to have a little freestyle on top. Annabelle Jones.
Annabelle Jones is, she makes kind of thoughtful but powerful pop music. She's very adamant that pop stars should do more to express themselves with meaning and purpose. So that's what she's aiming to do. Her debut EP, Libel, I assume is how you pronounce it, is out on the 6th of May. So you should check that out. And you should check out IOU, which is her new single.
And finally, Lyra.
Lyra, who I would say also is making thoughtful and powerful pop. She is Irish. She is a drummer, I believe, as well as singer. But there's no live drums, I don't think, on this track. So I don't know what her drumming skills are like. But her singing is good. She has a very distinctive and also quite diverse voice, which I believe you should check out on her debut single, Rabbit in the Headlights, which is what I approved. And you can go and listen to it either on the page where I approved it or in the Spotify playlist where it currently also resides, along with not all of those tracks. Actually, possibly all of them now.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved is where you can read more about all of these four approved acts and listen to the music and find links. Click on any approved and at the bottom you'll find the link to where you can go and access this Spotify playlist where everything we've approved this year, give or take.
There's only about four that aren't there.
You can listen to just by pressing play.
YouTube is the devil. That's the news this week. I'm not sure that's news. That's the general opinion of the music industry as we've discussed.
But this is a specific quote.
Yes.
This is not CMU speaking, because we call YouTube evil.
Yes. Whereas this is adding an extra letter.
An extra letter.
But there's a BBC documentary, a BBC radio documentary out about the business of music. It's called The Business of Music.
Good title.
Presented by Matt Everett, who used to present The Music Week.
He did.
On Six Music, but not anymore.
Not anymore.
That show finished.
Well, anyway, as a CMU podcast, there's no need for that programme.
Exactly. But now he's presenting this documentary. So on it, he interviewed various people, including Peter Mensch, who manages Metallica and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And he said that YouTube is the devil and also that it pays nothing, which I'm not sure that is true, but its payments are contentious.
Yeah, of course, the music industry's briefing against YouTube continues unabated. We've talked about this quite a lot on the podcast, how record companies and music publishers and artist managers and other people in the music business have been criticising YouTube because it operates an opt-out streaming service. Anyone can upload content. People routinely upload content. So as an artist, if you have any sort of fan base, your content is there. You have to ask for it to be removed. That is possible because of the safe harbours that exist in both European law and US law. And the record companies and the publishers and the collecting societies feel that that is giving YouTube an unfair negotiating hand when they're doing licensing deals. So YouTube, although obviously not a standalone music service, is a very popular destination for people who want to stream music. Therefore, it is a competitor to Spotify and Deezer and Apple Music. But YouTube has much more favourable terms than the audio services, mainly because the big music rights owners who normally drive a very hard bargain when they're negotiating with streaming services feel that because of these safe harbours, because YouTube already has the content, and if you don't want the content to be there, you have to request it be removed, has an unfair advantage at the negotiating table. And that is how YouTube has managed to get much more favourable terms. You're right that it is incorrect to say that YouTube doesn't pay anything to the music industry, because it does. Providing videos are monetized, so either the label or the publisher or both tell YouTube that they want to monetize the content, so that adverts appear, pre-rolls, banner ads, etc., etc. Providing there is advertising, then YouTube share 55% of that with whoever owns the sound recording, so the record company or possibly the artist direct if the artist is managing their own channels, and then they pay 10-12% to the publishers as well. But the big bugbear with YouTube, as far as the music rights owners are concerned, is that they only pay when there is revenue to share. Whereas obviously with the audio streaming services, what the music industry has done is to put all of the risk onto the digital platform. So if there is no revenue, the digital platform still has to pay. Whereas YouTube have managed to structure it so they don't take that risk. So if no advertising shows, and that could happen for one of three reasons, at least three reasons. I can definitely think of three reasons. One, nobody has monetized the content. So some random kid has uploaded your track, but you've not seen it. So you, the label, you, the artist, you, the publisher, you haven't monetized the content. So therefore, there's no revenue to share. Two, you've tried to monetize the content, but YouTube hasn't managed to sell any advertising. So although in theory there could be lots of advertising around your content, none of it's appearing. Or three, your viewers, Your fans are those pesky people who install ad blockers into their browsers, which means that even though you've asked for there to be advertising and YouTube has sold some advertising, the ads don't show and therefore you don't get your rev share. And so that is the crux of why the music industry has a gripe with YouTube. And as far as we're aware, all three of the majors are currently trying to renegotiate their deals with YouTube that cover both their own content on the platform and also when their content is used in user-generated content. So they're trying to play hard at the negotiating table, but they feel because of safe harbors, because of the opt-out element of the service, they can't push for the same deal that they get from a Spotify or an Apple Music. So as we know, concurrent to all of that, they have their lobbyists out in Brussels and Washington trying to get the law changed, try and get safe harbors. Safe harbors will still be in the law, but have it so that a YouTube type service is no longer protected under that bit of copyright law. So then negotiating hand is strengthened and the record companies and the publishers and the collecting societies can force YouTube into the kinds of deals that they've forced a Spotify or an Apple Music into. Although regular listeners of the podcast will know that as far as Andy Malt from CMU is concerned, none of that's going to happen.
No.
He's not convinced, and certainly some of the people we speak to who have some insider knowledge on this also aren't convinced that certainly in America there's only going to be any radical change to safe harbors as written in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And although there are a handful of people within the European Commission who are sympathetic towards the music industry's cause, Google is a phenomenal lobby in Brussels. Plus, of course, it's not just Google, it's not just YouTube. Facebook uses the safe harbors. Lots of other services are using the safe harbors, and it's quite a lobby to take on when the entire tech industry unites.
And also the rest of the entertainment industry, so TV and sport and film, are not, that, like, safe harbours are not the thing that they're particularly bothered about. There
yes.
are other things higher up their list for lobbying, so it's not like they can all team up together on this.
Exactly. So it's not to say that TV, film, etc. don't have problems with safe harbours and the way YouTube uses them, but the point is they have bigger concerns. And in terms of the wider copyright review in Europe, they're mainly obsessed by geo-blocking, which is a subject about which the music industry doesn't really care. So you're right, if the entire entertainment industry, and if you brought sport into that as well, as if you had the FA and people like that, were all lobbying on this, well, that would be a very loud voice to take on all the tech companies over here. But in the main, the film companies, the TV companies, etc. It's not that they're opposing what the music industry is calling for, but they're not putting much effort into it. Although, as we have referenced before, and this documentary proves, this is a rare moment where most of the music industry is speaking as one. So the record companies and the publishers, and as this documentary showed, many of the managers and artists as well, are calling for reform here. So most of the music industry is united on this. But that may well not be enough to get the copyright reform that you want. And actually, even if you did get some copyright reform, some change of the safe harbours, it will generally take 2 or 3 years for that to actually come into effect at a national level. Then the law will almost certainly be written in a really ambiguous, vague way, which will give YouTube and Google another couple of years to say, oh, we're already fulfilling that new requirement, even if they're not. So you're probably looking 4 or 5 years in the future, and who knows where digital music and the web and the internet and the way people consume content, where will it be in 5 years' time?
Yeah, and we should note YouTube's response is that, I mean, they always wheel out a stat. They would say, well, we have paid $3 billion into the record industry, so it's not true that we don't pay anything. Although they never give an exact time frame for that. I think they said $1 billion about 3 years ago. So it's still, it's a lot of money, but in terms of what, say, Spotify is paying into the industry, it's really kind of lagging behind.
And also, Spotify are usually quite precise when it comes to their figures. Whereas you're right, YouTube are always like, oh, we've paid about... Now, that's partly because of the way YouTube licensing is done and the way the money goes through the system, they can't be as precise because obviously YouTube are paying lots of content creators who have nothing to do with music. So it's not quite as easy a sum to do. But you're right, add a little bit of ambiguity into your statement and people are much more likely to go, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. The other thing YouTube put forward as a defence, which is also actually the defence that streaming services like Spotify, Deezer, all those use as well to artists, is that, hey, you've just done bad deals. If you're not getting enough money, we're paying it. It's just getting filtered out along the way to you, and it's nothing to do with us.
Yeah, so for someone like Peter Mensch, who obviously isn't representing a label or a publisher or a collecting society, he is closer to artists, he's in management, and so the line they would wheel out to artists and managers, and there's an element of truth in this, is we're not the problem, it's what happens between us and you. Okay, we don't pay the money to you directly, we pay it to a distributor, to a label, to a publisher, to a collecting society. God knows what happens to the money before it hits your artist's bank account. That's where the problem's happening. It may well be that actually the problem is happening everywhere. That there are problems at the DSP DSP's side, as well as what's happening in between. But it is interesting that with YouTube, the music industry seems united. The trade bodies and the collecting societies and the artists and the managers are standing side by side with the big bad labels and the collecting societies, etc. on this. Although that said, if you talk to the grassroots artist community and the sort of younger managers who are working with young talent, and I've been talking to a lot of those people for various reasons in recent months, actually, although at the top the music rights industry is united on this, there are people lower down who say, well, we would like more money from YouTube, and we're sort of sympathetic to the safe harbours debate. Having said that, for my new artists, YouTube is such an important platform, and we get great data, we make a little bit of advertising money, and we use YouTube as a way of reaching fans and around which we build the rest of the business. Actually, we kind of like YouTube. And crucially, the question is, well, what's the standoff here? Say you got your safe harbour change. Say you went to YouTube and said, right, everything's now changed, this is the deal, take it or leave it. And YouTube said, well, music's important to YouTube, but it's not that important to YouTube, so we'll leave it. Then what happens to these newer artists who have built their entire careers around YouTube channels?
Speaking of which, the other thing YouTube's been talking up, other than the billions of dollars that it's just throwing around, is its new Music Foundry, which is it working directly with artists in a way that it does with creators generally already, but kind of bringing people in and giving them access to production facilities and expertise at Google's London, LA and New York offices to create content to put on their YouTube channels and then make loads of money.
Well, manage the channels as best as you can,
yeah,
to bring in the revenue that might be available to you. And YouTube has been supporting YouTube creators, YouTubers, whatever we're calling them, for a few years now. And there have been a few music-based YouTube artists in amongst all of that. But this seems to be a new initiative. It is pushing all of that much more into the grassroots music industry. And I suppose trying to circumvent the labels and the publishers and the collecting societies and the trade bodies with which relationships really ain't going very well at the moment, and reaching out to that grassroots talent and their managers, so not a Peter Mensch, but the sort of the younger managers or the managers who work a lot more with sort of new YouTube-oriented talent, and saying, yeah, let's put all of that to the side and let's work together, create great content, and then let's work out how we can make money out of that. So it's interesting to see them pushing that much more into the music space with this YouTube Foundry initiative. It's always hard to tell when things like this come along, because there's talk of YouTube setting aside a significant chunk of money to spend on original music content that which will then go out through its platform. But it's always hard to tell, because YouTube are generally quite vague when they make statements. How much of this is a new initiative? How much of this? Because, I mean, YouTube have been putting money into music channels, yeah, on its platform for a number of years now. So how much is actually something brand new or a response to the safe harbours quagmire or whatever? Or how much actually is just what they've always done, but they've given it a new name? But anyway, YouTube continues. If you're coming to The Great Escape, we've got a whole day looking at YouTube, all elements of YouTube, a bit about the licensing debate, a little bit about how to get the most out of your YouTube channel in 2016, and then exactly these artists who are building careers out of their YouTube channels and the managers they're working with, who, while not necessarily in disagreement with Peter Mensch on the safe harbours point and that they would like a better arrangement with YouTube, I don't think we'll be calling YouTube the devil, because YouTube is the platform through which they are building their talent and building businesses around their talent. So do come to the YouTube Strand on day one of CMU Insights The Great Escape on the 19th of May for more YouTube stuff. And all this is happening so fast at the moment, God knows where we'll be in a month's time when we return on the podcast with the music industry versus YouTube battle.
Just time to run through a few of the stories that we have not had time to discuss in detail this week.
Despite this being a bumper edition of the CMU podcast, but that's because we're going away.
Yeah. So we really, once again, don't have time to talk about these stories, but we're going to
do it anyway. Because you've got 4 weeks to listen to this podcast.
Brian Johnson is not a quitter.
Despite him quitting AC/DC.
Well, to be fair, if I was told that I could carry on playing with AC/DC, but I would go totally deaf, quite likely, if I did, I would probably stop doing it as well. So it was announced this week that Axl Rose had replaced Brian Johnson as AC/DC frontman for the rest of their Rock or Bust tour. Then Brian Johnson, well, that had been the rumour for weeks anyway, but it was confirmed. Anyway, so Brian Johnson then put out a statement saying, I want to detail exactly what happened here. which I'm not sure that, I don't know, maybe people were calling him a quitter, but it seemed fair enough if someone says we're going to go.
But I suppose he was clarifying, wasn't he, that what he's not able to do because of his current medical
condition. It's arena and stadium shows. He could do smaller shows, but AC/DC don't do smaller shows. He can still do recording studio work, so if AC/DC are recording, then he'll do that. But for the foreseeable future, and he did sort of say, this isn't necessarily a permanent thing, but I need to work on kind of getting my ears working again. But yeah, for the foreseeable future, he will not be able to tour with the band.
So it may be that he continues to put out albums with the band, but then when they tour those albums, Axl Rose does the vocals. So, yeah, that's interesting.
The latest development in the mechanical royalties battle with Spotify. David Lowry's lawyers have demanded access to the correspondence that Spotify has been sending to songwriters. So we discussed recently that Spotify agreed a settlement with the National Music Publishers Association in the US over mechanical royalties that have not been paid to some songwriters where they didn't know who they were. Those people couldn't have the money that's owed to them, plus a little bit extra to say sorry if they agree not to join any of the class action lawsuits that are currently being brought out against Spotify, which have the potential to cost Spotify a lot more money. But crucially, there's a deadline on that, which is there's a 3-month window, and that potentially will be a deadline that comes before it's decided that these lawsuits can be class actions.
Yeah, so that's crucial. So David Lowry is one of the songwriters who's pursuing this litigation. There's a separate lawsuit that's going through against Spotify on the mechanical rights issues. They both want to be class actions. And if they are class actions, that means that then any songwriter who has unpaid mechanicals from Spotify can then be part of the class and benefit in any damages that are then awarded at the end of the litigation without them having to pursue their own lawsuits. So it would make the process of suing Spotify on this issue a lot simpler for all of the other songwriters. However, the judge has to give the lawsuit class action status. He hasn't done that yet because of the deadline on the settlement, which means that songwriters who think, actually, I want to go the litigation route rather than the NMPA Spotify settlement route, because ultimately I could make more money by going the lawsuit route. But it might turn out that if I don't accept the settlement and the deadline expires and then the judge doesn't give the case class action status, then I can't go either route. I'd have to find my own lawyer and fight my own litigation, which probably is impractical. So what the lawyers for David Lowry were saying this week is that they feel that Spotify and NMPA are being a little bit unfair in the way that they've structured their settlement and crucially in the way they're communicating it. And so they want to see all the emails that have been sent out to songwriters to make sure that those songwriters are not being misled. And if they are being misled, then they'll go back to court and ask the judge to intervene and possibly force Spotify and NMPA to send out clarification or corrections. So, an interesting development in a long-running case that we will definitely be coming back to when we return for series 3 of the podcast.
And last on our list, the Sunday Times Rich List is out. And It will be this weekend, but they've already released data on rich musicians, and it turns out that they are all still rich.
Yes, Paul McCartney still has money.
U2 still collectively as one entity. It's always weird, isn't it, how some people are alone. In fact, Paul McCartney's not even alone, because it's him and his wife are classed as one entity.
That's right. And then U2 are listed as one entity, but then the Rolling Stones, I think, are listed separately. So that never makes any sense.
One Direction are all one entity.
Except Zayn,
except
of course.
Zayn now. So, yeah, it's a weird list. But, yeah, so Paul McCartney is at the top, as always. The wealthiest musician under 30 is Adele.
Of course,
as you would expect. But she's apparently doubled her fortune in the last year, pretty much. And as a result, is now the wealthiest female musician from the UK who has ever lived. Although still slightly less wealthy than Enya, who is Irish.
Yeah, that's always one of the asides when the Sunday Times put out the music-specific rich list. Every year at this time of year, there's always the reminder that actually, because the list also includes Ireland, it's actually the rich list of the UK and Ireland, the most successful artist financially out of the UK and Ireland, a female artist, is Enya, who's still up there very high with all of her millions and millions of pounds.
She's doing very well.
So well done, Enya, for still being so damn successful and generating all those articles this time of the year where everyone says, how can that be? But hey, Orinoco Flow was a great record, so obviously that's what did it.
Controversial opinion there. Maybe not, I don't know.
But all right then.
What's
all right record. I'll backtrack slightly
maybe
on that.
Maybe that can be our question this week for some of you to ponder for the next month. What does the world feel about Orinoco Flow? Was that a great record or an okay record? Or is it just terrible?
And younger listeners can look up Orinoco Flow on YouTube. I'm sure it's there. And make your own opinion on that.
But yeah, to read all of those stories in excruciating detail, go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast. Find the show notes for this show and you'll find the links in there.
Let's do the final story because I've got a train to catch to Edinburgh.
Yes, let's
I've got to get to Wide Days.
It is Chris Cook this week boldly stated that this was his, did you say favourite litigation story of the year or all time?
I possibly said both of those. No? Or perhaps I said one in the story and one to you. This is a great bit of pop litigation. I mean, it's a nonsense lawsuit. I mean, it's
brilliant.
Pretty much at the top of the list of all-time nonsense pop music-related lawsuits, but it's fun.
Yes.
Not that I'm advocating the misuse of the American legal system for insane nonsense lawsuits, but if you're going to do it, make it fun, and this is fun.
So a Kanye West fan, Justin Baker-Rett, is suing Kanye West and Tidal, and with the lawsuit he's trying to get class action status for, on the grounds that Kanye West lied when he said that his album would only ever be on Tidal.
And thus encouraging this guy to sign up to Tidal in order to access the new Kanye album at the point at which, according to Kanye West's Twitter feed, Tidal was not only the only place to listen to the album now, it was the only place you would ever be able to hear this album.
This is based on a tweet, which is always great grounding for a lawsuit, when Kanye said, "My album will never, never, never be on Apple, and it will never be for sale. You can only get it on Tidal."
Now, we talked about this on the podcast.
We did.
Around about the time of the release of the new Kanye album and all the confusion about where it was going to be available and when it was going to be available. We talked about this tweet, the fact that he was adamant that it was never going to be on Apple Music, it was never going to be for sale. And we also talked about the fact that 2 weeks later, the album appeared on Apple Music and is very much available for sale.
Yes, it's on all the streaming services and you can buy it from his website. Now, bootleg copies of the album on vinyl appeared for Record Store Day.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
But they were not official, so I don't think Kanye can be sued for those.
The other thing we discussed back on the podcast when all of this was happening and we had the tweet and then we had it arriving on all those other services, we discussed whether or not Kanye could be held to this tweet, which might have seemed like a ridiculous thing to be discussing at the time.
But maybe Justin Baker-Rett was listening.
But turns out that it was of legal significance. Could Kanye be held to account for saying it would never, never, never be on Apple Music? And then it was on Apple Music. And what we discussed at the time was those few weeks when the new album was on Tidal but nowhere else, the album wasn't actually finished. And if you'd listened to the album on the first day it was loaded on Tidal, and then a week later, then a week later, then a week later, Kanye kept tweaking the tracks, which from a creative standpoint is a very interesting idea and something that's only possible in streaming age, that an album can be evolving even once it's out there in public. But we also said at the time that what that meant was that although the new Kanye album did eventually make it onto Apple Music, Spotify, et al., the version that was streaming on Tidal at the precise time that that tweet went out never did make it to the other streaming services, because by the time it got rolled out to the other platforms, the album had changed. And pretty much every track, I think, by that point had changed.
Yeah, so, I mean, technically you could argue, and I'm sure if this ever gets to court, this will be argued, that it is a different album. It's not the album that Kanye was talking about. Oh, the songs might be the same, but hey, is a live album where a band plays an album in full the same as the original album? No, it is not. So no one can be sued at all. Let's all leave this alone.
It sounds like you're going to be called as an expert witness for Kanye West.
Yes, I would happily get involved in this quite silly lawsuit. However, but the lawsuit claims that users who signed up to Tidal had been duped into doing so, that the company was on the verge of collapse before this exclusive or supposedly exclusive deal was done, and that has benefited from farming the personal data of these people who signed up thinking that this was the only way they could listen to the album, who would not have signed up had they known that a month later it was going to be available elsewhere.
Yes, there was a whole section of the lawsuit dedicated to the fact that, of course, you're not committed to stay with Tidal. So if you joined and you'd listened to the music, then you can cancel your subscription. But the lawyers have fought of that. Even though you could cancel your subscription, by that point, you've invested time in signing up. You've gone through the process of infecting your phone with the Tidal app, and you've provided all of your data, including your credit card information, to the Tidal company. So even if you're not actually locked to stay with Tidal beyond that period where it was exclusive to that service, You've had all of the hassle and all of the data handing over. So actually, these people, bearing in mind, as you say, they want class action status. So then it would be anyone who signed up to Tidal while the candidate
track. And as we know, Tidal was recently claiming quite a lot of new users.
But even though all of those people may have cancelled their accounts, apparently there is still a case against it. And the actual legal filing was great because all of Kanye's tweets were screen grabbed and were put, and they were talking about the media coverage that had stemmed out from it and how Kanye's Twitter feed is really widely read and very significant. So if you can get yourself a copy of the actual legal filing, it's quite long, but it's
they always are.
But it is quite entertaining. And then I think there's four things they're accusing. Well, actually, as is often the case when Tidal gets sued, they're actually suing Jay-Z's company. I know Jay-Z's company, whenever that happens, is very keen to say, hang on a second, Tidal's a separate company, sue them. So they're suing Jay-Z and Kanye and Tidal, and it was unjust enrichment, false advertising, and there was a couple of other things as well. I can't quite remember what. So favourite nonsense lawsuit, certainly of the week, probably of the year, and maybe of all time.
We'll see how it pans out.
I'm looking forward to the responses, which may or may not come. So let's see where we're at in 4 weeks' time, 5 weeks' time. We're taking 4 weeks off. So
yeah,
5 weeks' time when we return, whether or not this lawsuit has moved forward or if an even more nonsensical pop music-based lawsuit has been filed to compete with this one.
You've got a month to file the most ridiculous lawsuit you can think of. So when you've done that, please do tweet us at CMU with the lawsuit that you're filing.
Yeah, give us a link.
Give us a link. See if you can make it class action.
You'll have to sue in the US for
you'll
that.
You'll have to sue in the US for that. But if not, you can sue in Europe as well. It doesn't have to be class action. And if you can base it on a tweet, that would be great. But, you know, as I say, you've got a month to think about it. So don't rush into it. Really sit down and think of it because, that's the end of this series of the CMU podcast, apparently. Why not play your favourite bit of this episode to a friend? Also, do make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast so that when we return for Series 3, I think it is.
Of the rebooted CMU podcast.
Series 3, you automatically get it and you don't have to miss out on anything.
And if you're at Wide Days or you're at Music Connected or you're at Canadian Music Week or you're at The Great Escape, do come and find us and say hello. Because that would be nice.
Yeah.
It's always nice to say hello to people.
I enjoy saying hello.
And I'll give you a promotional postcard, because obviously you'll be deprived of my blatant plugs for CMU activity for the next month. So I'll give you a postcard to keep you going with the blatant plugs.
I will have postcards in my bag, but will forget to give you
as
one.
So it's always
it's your choice. I am Andy Malt. He is Chris Cook. This podcast produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7Digital.
Let's end that one on a downer.